Tonight, as I mentioned in my email, I've chosen this topic, karma and rebirth. And I want to start by saying I'm not an expert on this in the sense that what I know is what I've read about and some very small experiences I've had along those lines. But most of what I'm going to talk about is just, this is what the Buddha said, this is what people who teachers I respect have said, and try and sort of synthesize it and put it together in that way to hopefully make sense of it in some way. So first of all, the word karma itself. It's an interesting word in that it has these sort of multiple meanings. The two main ones are, one translation of karma is simply action. You know, the actual process of doing something. But another meaning of karma is the results of that action. So this is the process of doing and also what happens when you've done it. And these are both related meanings of that same word, karma. So what we're talking about is acting in the world. And it basically, it comes down to, in one simple way, you could say, you know, wholesome, skillful acts have wholesome karma, the results. You know, and unwholesome, unskillful acts have unwholesome karma, unwholesome results. It's pretty much a straight line story there. But that's like the first level gloss of it, right? But so I want to read, I'm going to read several from several different places here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he has some wise words about this, I think. And he starts this way. For many of us, this concept, this idea of karma, is probably outside the realm of our own direct experience. And it also outside the mainstream of Western thought. I mean, this is really, of all the teachings in Buddhism, this is the one that is most Eastern. It isn't something you see in any of the Western traditions at all. So in some ways, it's difficult because it doesn't resonate because it isn't culturally built in for us. And then Joseph goes on. For me, there was a gradual process and opening to these possibilities. I came to Dharma practice from a study of Western philosophy and had no belief at all in past and future lives or other realms of existence. Over time, though, several things began to open my mind. First, the more I practiced and studied Dharma, because much of what the Buddha said, taught did resonate with me, what I was experiencing. So other parts of the Buddha teachings made sense and felt right. I began to think that if he has been right about so much, maybe I should keep an open mind for what is still beyond my immediate experience. It's a big ask, huh? Got to keep an open mind to some things that are beyond my immediate experience. So he says, I began practicing poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge's willing suspension of disbelief. And this is a really interesting idea. It's like he's not saying, and I'm not saying, believe. Don't take this as dogma. Don't take it on faith. But suspend your disbelief. So, which is that's in a sense a good definition of having an open mind. And just sort of be open to these ideas and go, oh yeah, I could see that. That sort of makes sense, which is sort of where I am with this stuff. And then he says this really important thing. I saw that just as we can become attached to our belief systems, we can become attached to our disbeliefs. That's a really interesting idea, right? So we can become attached to what we for sure is wrong. I don't believe that at all. We can become just as attached to that as to some idea or dogma or belief system that we were sure is true. In both cases, we have to just suspend our disbelief, live in that middle ground of openness to what is. So, as far as the actual process of karma unfolding, of karma being created, it's important to understand that only acts that are intentional. So you're walking along and you're not paying attention, perhaps, and you accidentally kick something, somebody, just totally out of, because you're spaced out and not paying attention. You had no intention to do that. That has no karmic result. There's no energy of karma created from that act. So it's like that we have to have formed an intention, and then volition, the faculty or power of using one's will, has to arise. Like we form the intention to do something, that's one mental level. Then there's volition, which is the actual process of making it happen, separate mental formation. And if those two aren't there, then there's no karma. So you could form an intention, but if you don't do actually, you don't act on it, there's no karma there either. You actually have to form the intention and actually do something, act in some way. And then the actual results, these karmic, the results of the action, they're yours. Whatever act you take, the results of that action is yours to live with. It's sort of in your pile of stuff that you have to now deal with. And it may be that the results of these actions occur very directly, and you can see this happening in this particular lifetime. Later on in life, you do something, and then, maybe an hour later, you go, "Oh my God, look, I did that, and look what's happening." So it might be that, people joke about instant karma, right? But it's true. Sometimes karma reacts in that very quick way, and sometimes it might be, something you did 30 years ago, and all of a sudden something arises, and you go, "Oh, yeah, I can see how this is related to that." And so it's like it's a and this is something that we all sort of, on some level, we intuitively understand. There's that old saw, as you sow, so you will reap. Straight out of the Bible. As you sow, so shall you reap. So whatever, you're sowing actions, and then you're gonna reap the results. It's just, we sort of intuitively understand that. And this isn't just a religious thing. This is like something that's sort of embedded in sort of being human. We have some intuitive understanding, and all humans have an intuitive understanding of this. One of my teachers, actually two of my teachers, who lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, went into the high danger juvenile hall prison to teach Dharma. I mean, talk about a place to go. I mean, these are young people who have been, murdered people and armed robbery and all kinds of like horrible things, right? But they're going to go in and teach them Dharma. And it's like there's, like in all prisons, there's, especially in this one, there was like a couple of gangs and gang leaders, and they could see, over the course of three or four talks that they gave jointly, these two very high level respected teachers in the tradition, that it wasn't sinking in. People weren't getting it. They weren't paying that much attention almost. It was sort of like, oh, we get to go, here we can just sit and listen to these guys blather for half an hour. And there was some little bits of interaction, but not a lot going on. And then they gave a talk on karma, and the one of the gang leaders said, "Ah, oh, you mean like what goes around comes around?" And they said, "Yeah, that's it." And all of a sudden, this guy had all kinds of questions, and everybody else got interested just because he had this. Even he was like a violent gang leader, but he understood what goes around comes around. So this is like, it's sort of built into us at some level. We understand this in terms of what happens in this life, right? And in the long term, we start thinking about, well, what about this thing about rebirth, which is the other, it's, I mean, karma and rebirth and reincarnation are really tightly wedded together. And when we get to, so up until now, it's like, yeah, I can see this at all. I can sort of, even my own experience, I've had experiences like that. And then we go, yeah, but now there's rebirth here. They keep talking about, the results of this, of my actions affecting something later, after I die, and something happens at that point. And this is where, for my, I mean, I have obviously, I've had really tiny, dreamlike, odd experiences at times where I sort of felt, oh, yeah, this is, I could sort of sense the action that was arising. What was happening was based on something that wasn't happening, wasn't based on anything that had happened in this lifetime at all. It had something from some other time was the motivating energy behind it. And I can't explain it any better than that, because, but that was the, it was a really sort of an intuitive sense that that's what was going on here, that something had happened back there outside this particular physical body lifetime that was now arising and affecting this moment, it had arisen. And so it has some reality to me in that sense. That's about as far as it goes, to be honest with you. That little taste of reality. But there's a lot more to be said, obviously. In some sense, in the long term, even in this lifetime, karma can be taken simply as the result of birth. We got born, and there was karma there that came along with that birth. And then we had to, in some sense, experience some of that karmic energy in this lifetime. And then we get sick and we get old and we die, like everybody else. It's not like, this is going to change anything in terms of the cycle of life. It's going to affect what happens in this life to a certain extent. And it all, I mean, it really makes sense, really. I mean, you do something wholesome, you get to remember that act later, and you get to feel good again. I mean, you do something wholesome, the natural thing about doing something wholesome is the residue of that is it has this sort of sweet energy, this sweet feeling. And you think about it later, and it's like, oh, you get that sweet feeling again. This is karma. Does the karma of that wholesome act was you get to feel good again, just like that. And it might be, like I said, something that you did 50 years ago, or it might be something you did yesterday or this afternoon. But of course, the other is also true. We do something unwholesome, Oh, then we remember this and we go, oh yeah, and we feel bad. This is the direct result of the action. This is one way to, this is, I'm just trying to give different ways of looking at this, right? But it's like the problem with this is the misunderstanding of karma. You know, that as it's sort of gone from both, it's both true and it's misunderstood in this way in Eastern cultures as well, but in the West it's even more so because it's sort of a foreign idea that we're sort of adding on to, that somehow karma means you're stuck, you're gonna get this stuff, that's it, your life is predetermined, it's all destined to be a certain way. But this I want to read this wonderful. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. For those of you taking notes about what this is 30 in Samyutta Nikaya 36:21. And in this particular place, this is one of those many places where a Brahmin, I think in this case, has come to question the Buddha and sort of in some sense debate with the Buddha to a certain extent. And he's talking about this particular idea, right? On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagaha in the bamboo grove. Then the wanderer Mulayaksa approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, there are ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful or pleasant, all of this is caused by what has been done in the past. So everything we experience is based directly on karma from the past, whether it's from this particular life or from past lives. And this is the Buddha's reply. Some feelings, Shivaka, arise here originating from bile disorders. That some feeling arise here originating from bile disorders, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what is done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. So he's saying, not only do they not know this because they haven't experienced it, but it's like it's common knowledge, like I was talking about earlier. Therefore, I say that is wrong on the part of these ascetics and Brahmins. And then he goes through and he lists, he says, some feelings, Shivaka, arise from originating from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders. These are Ayurvedic principles, right? Originating from the imbalance of the three, produced by a change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault. These are all things that happen in our lives that also can affect what we experience in the moment, that have nothing to do with our karma at all. Nothing whatsoever. What the Buddha is saying is, it's like, yes, karma arises, and sometimes the results of the karma are experienced in this lifetime, and we have to accept that. But don't for one second think that your life is totally predestined and you have no control over all this stuff. Because a lot of it is just random stuff. Just totally random stuff that happens. You know, you have indigestion because you ate, the curry you ate for lunch was too spicy. And that makes you feel a certain way or think a certain way. It has nothing to do with a past life. It's just what's happening now. And so on and so on. And And so I think it's really important that we understand this, because this is a really common misconception. There's a woman I knew who didn't have that great a life. She had a lot of struggles. Her husband left her and things. And she just blamed it all on her karma. Like, oh, my karma is so bad. It's like my life is falling apart, but is this my karma? And, wait a second. I'm sorry. There's other factors that you have to think about. And you can't just blame everything on karma, because then that removes, in a sense, it's like to do that is like to remove yourself from any responsibility. It's not my fault. It's just my karma. It's so easy to go there and just sort of let karma be the thing that gets blamed. I have no control over this. So it's an interesting thing we have to watch for. So basically, I just wanted to sort of sum this up. Karma does not mean predestination, or that our life is controlled from above, or that we have no choice. The seeds you plant through your actions will sprout. Here's the other really important point. Things will arise based on past karma in this lifetime. It's just the way things are, according to Buddhist teachings. And we have no control over that at all. They're just like other things that arise. Like I say, you walk along and you trip over something. That isn't karma. This is life, right? But some of the things that arise that you have to deal with are come from karma from the past, from past actions. You can't control that. You have nothing. It doesn't mean that you're a good person or a bad person or whatever. It's just that's how it is. But here's what's important. No matter what that karmic energy causes to arise in this life, at this point, at this moment, we have absolute freedom to choose how to react to that. That's where the freedom of this practice comes from. The freedom of this whole practice is that we are consciously learning to choose to react, to just not fall into automatic patterns, into repeated old patterns. We're actually choosing to react in a certain way and dealing with what's arising in a certain skillful way. That's the power of this practice. And that doesn't change just because that thing that's arising is from some sort of karmic energy. That isn't changed at all. It's just, if we're mindful and full of loving kindness, no matter what's arising, then how we act based on what's arising in this moment becomes more wholesome karma. So no matter what it was, no matter what it was back there, if in this at this moment and something arises, and it might be it's really painful and ugly and horrible, but we react in a wholesome, mindful way, then that reaction, which is a wholesome reaction, creates more wholesome karma. It's a wheel, it's a cycle. It goes on and on and on and on. So basically, if you're mindful and full of loving kindness when something difficult arises, you will deal with it much better than if you're distracted and full of ill will. This is why we practice. In one level, this is the reason we practice. We practice so that we can learn to react skillfully to whatever arises, including these things that arise out of events back there someplace. Ah. Some more Joseph Goldstein here. Examining the deeper implications of this step on the path leads us to subtler understandings of the Buddhist teachings. For example, Bhikkhu Bodhi points out that acts of killing can be driven by greed, hatred, or delusion, and that killing driven by hatred is most serious, particularly if it is premeditated, because there may have been many intense moments that have gone into planning and thinking about it. Always, the unwholesome karma is proportional to the force and strength and duration of the defilements. So did I put a lot of energy into this, or did I just get caught in a reaction and do something stupid in the moment? This is, I mean, and you think about our legal system, they acknowledge this. I mean, there's a big, lot very different penalties for premeditated murder versus, say, manslaughter. But we're still, there's still acts of killing. But one of them is like long and thought out and carefully. And it's like, this is no different in the karmic effects that they're talking about. Joseph goes on. Later teachings also explain that the consequences or results of an action are conditioned by the moral qualities of both the actor and the recipient of the act. This is true of both negative and positive actions. For example, on the positive side, gifts are purified both by the motivation of the giver and also the purity of the recipient. In this light, it was considered an inestimable merit to make an offering to the Buddha or to other enlightened beings. And at the same time, in the perfection of generosity, we give without discrimination whenever the opportunity is there. It's not that an act of generosity or an act of harm has some absolute karmic consequence. Rather, the karmic fruits of these actions are conditioned by various factors, including the intensity and duration of the defilements or wholesome motivations, and the purity of both the actor and the recipient of the action. So this isn't like, you know, one size fits all. It's just cut and dried. Oh, that will get you 37 karma points, and that'll get you 37 karma demerits. It depends a lot on all these other factors. And it's just something that, it's an interesting idea to think about it in this way, that it's like, it's not simple in any sense. It's not like a simple just tick off the right box and that's how much you're gonna, that's what the karma is going to be. You know, there's also things like speaking of killing, for instance, you're in a room with a bunch of other people. Some guy comes in and he's got a gun and he's about to shoot all these people, and you kill him. That's a wholesome act, because it's the intent of the person who did that to protect all these other people. Now killing just became a wholesome act. And then you can see how this gets difficult. Now, well, what about wars? And I mean, you can go on and on and on about this one. I don't want to go there. But it's like, it's not all absolute cut and dried. It comes down to the intention and the energy behind the actor and who the receiver of the action. And that's, it's important to remember that. So then we got, that's a lot about karma. What about this whole idea of reincarnation or rebirth is another word for it. And I want to reiterate right here. I don't know this to be true. I haven't consciously experienced it directly, but it just makes sense to me. And I want to actually start in a little bit of an indirect way. This is another thing from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is another case where a Brahmin comes to and says, He wants to ask some questions. And he's asking, actually asking not the Buddha, but this great student called Maha Kassapa. He says, "How is it, friend Kassapa? Does the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this, that Tathagata exists after death." "Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death?" The Blessed One said, "He has not declared this either, that Tathagata does not exist after death." "How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death." "Then, friend," this guy's Kassapa is really trying to get down to it here. "Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death?" You know, the double negations, right? "The Blessed Friend has not declared this either." So at this point, Kassapa's going, "Come on now. It's got to be one of these four things. He exists or he doesn't exist, or he both exists and doesn't exist, or he neither. It's got to be one of these four. This is classical philosophical discourse method, right? That was very common in India. It's actually common today. But so finally, this guy says, "Why hasn't the Blessed One declared this, friend? Like, how? Wait, it's got to be one of these four. Why hasn't the Buddha said something about this?" And he says, "Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to dispassion, to cessation, to peace." So he's saying, trying to figure out what happens after death to the Buddha is irrelevant to the practice. Wow, that's an interesting thought. But why is it irrelevant? And it's irrelevant, and this is the deeper meaning here, is all four of those questions assume underneath that there's a separate self called the Buddha that's going to exist or not exist after death, that there's some separate self that actually is going to exist, and then therefore is going to have something's going to happen to it when the body falls away. And the reason the Buddha thought this wasn't useful is he knew that to be not true. Oh, well, here we are in the midst of non-self discussion, right? But that's also part of what we have to take in to sort of understand what's going on here, because, and this is important, and this is another common misunderstanding of reincarnation. Reincarnation or rebirth, we somehow get the idea that me, this personality, this person, is going to come back and have a new body. But in sense of absolute reality, this me, this separate me, doesn't exist. So how could it come back? I'm just giving you things to think about, because these are exactly things I think about when I try and I can't. I don't have an answer. Like I said, I don't know any of this to be true. But this is how it's been explained to me, and how I've sort of learned to be comfortable with this whole idea. So basically, instead of thinking that me is going to come back, there's going to be another Barry arising somehow. Whether that's good or bad, if that's up to you to decide, but it ain't going to happen. But when this particular body came into existence. Attached to it, use the word attached in a loose sense, connected to it, part of it somehow, at some level, was what we'll call a bundle of karmic energy. Those are the words my teacher Guy used when he explained this. So there's this bundle of karmic energy that comes along with having a human body. It's just part of the deal. And it's that bundle that has stuff in it that arises and takes place that we have to deal with in this lifetime. And then, but at the same time, we're adding to everything we do, every act we take, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, is adding into that bundle, affecting that bundle. And when this physical body passes, then that, however that bundle has been affected, that effect, that collection of effect that's been added to it, is part of that bundle. And the next time that bundle connects to a human body that's being born, that's what that body has to deal with. So throughout this life, this bundle is changing all the time. You know, and some of the things in the bundle that we add, you know, at 20 are going to come out again at 60, and some of them are going to come out to the next body somewhere down the line. There, who knows? It's not going to be me. I'm not going to be, in that sense, directly affected by my actions in my next life, because I'm not going to, me, Barry, isn't going to have a next life. Me, Barry, is done. When this body goes, this is done. There's no me anymore to come. There's no me in the first place. And so what happens, and here's the key to this. I want to read something more from Joseph. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. And he's talking about this idea. Although a seed will bear a particular fruit, clearly the seed itself is not the fruit, nor is the seed somehow carried into the fruit. Rather, a process of transformation is happening according to certain laws. The seed grows into a sapling, the sapling into a tree. A tree bears fruit, which brings forth new seed. The first seed is not pulled up through the trunk and then deposited in the fruit, miraculously splitting into all those other little seeds. Rather, the seed undergoes a process of transformation due to certain conditions such as sun, rain, and fertile soil. There is no one element that remains static throughout this process. Rather, one thing becomes another, continuously. What actually happens is, in the great unfolding from seed to fruit to seed again, is an unbroken continuum of becoming, of ceaseless change. In fact, these changes are happening so rapidly and so continuously that to isolate any one moment and call it a thing already solidifies too much and renders too static what is so dynamic and transformational. All of the elements of our mind and body are arising and passing away, changing continuously, transforming in exactly the same way. To say there is no self means there's no permanent entity that carries from lifetime to lifetime, or even from moment to moment. Oh, interesting. Every moment is a new life, and then there's another life, and then there's another life. It's always changed, and it's always different. It's never the same. It's another thing to take in somehow. So basically, here's the idea. when we die, this bundle that we came on, that came in, when we came with us as we were born, it eventually takes birth in another body. And gradually that bundle changes, and it becomes, because hopefully it's connected with more and more wholesome lives and more wholesome actions that create the make the bundle more wholesome as things go along. Eventually, it's going to be a human birth with that particular bundle that becomes an enlightened being. That's how enlightened beings happen. And it's this ongoing process of this energy collecting and getting stronger and stronger and stronger until such a point that at some point there's this amazing thing called an enlightened being arising. Here's the interesting thing. Here's another interesting thing. At that point, that bundle done its job in a sense. An enlightened being has arisen in the world, which is really important, obviously. When you look at what happened to the enlightened beings, I mean, just think of the Buddha and Jesus just for a start. Well, there's two enlightened beings. Think what they've done in terms of wholesomeness in the world over the last 2,000, 2,500 years. So having an enlightened being arise is really important. But then that bundle is done. It's an enlightened being is born. Then the bundle itself dissolves. It's gone. Just like everything else, even these bundles of karmic energy that take new bodies and new bodies and new bodies and new bodies, they're impermanent. Even they're going to, at some point, be gone, just like that. When that enlightened being leaves its body, that bundle of karmic energy is finished. Poof, gone. It's just another impermanent arising. So these, I try and think of an image, and it's like we often talk about the stream of things that we're basically part of and floating in the midst of, this stream of things that are constantly arising and being there and then going away, this stream of constant change and arising. And these bundles of karmic energy are like in this stream. And then something happens so that a human being is about to be born, and this bundle connects to that human being. It's believed, I'll leave this for you to decide whether you, how comfortable you are with this, that this happens at inception. So that egg and that sperm connect together, and a being starts, and there's a bundle of karmic energy attached at that moment. Take that. I won't go any further with that, but that's because that has all kinds of implications when you start to think about it. So here's one thing you're going to be tempted to ask, and I'm going to tell you, don't ask this question. That is like, where did these bundles come from in the first place? And this is like one of the, what the Buddha calls the imponderables. This is like, this is a version of that question, how did the universe start? How is the universe going to end? And the Buddha very, very precisely in several places in the sutta says, don't even think about it. These are imponderables. Don't waste your energy trying to figure this one out, because it can't be figured out. It's like what his teachings are based on, or this is what he actually experienced. He, unlike me, he actually knew through his own experience the truth of what I've been trying to explain. And that's the only way we can grasp this at all. And to try and figure out those sorts of questions are things that the Buddha very strongly warned against bothering to even try and think about. Because you'll make yourself crazy, basically, trying to figure them out. One more. This is a book called What the Buddha Taught by Wapola Rahula. He's talking about this sort of thing. Therefore, there cannot be words to express the experience. Just as a fish has no words in his vocabulary to express the nature of solid land. The tortoise told his friend, the fish, that he, the tortoise, just returned to the lake after a walk on the land. Of course, the fish said, you mean swimming. The tortoise tried to explain that one couldn't swim on the land, that it was solid, and that one walked on it. But the fish insisted that there could be nothing like it, that it must be liquid like his lake with waves. And one must be able to swim and dive there. This is a little story talking about our limited understanding, our limited ability to understand. Because we're talking about trying to understand something that's totally beyond our experience. And so trying to figure it out is like, why are we doing this? Why are we beating ourselves up trying to figure this out when this is really, why can't we just go, okay, right now, why can't I just suspend my disbelief? Going back to the very beginning of this talk almost. Why can't I just suspend my disbelief and go, okay, this seems to be what the Buddha kept saying over and over again, because this is, you see all this talk, but in very many places in the sutta. So I just have to sort of suspend my disbelief, be aware that this is a thought, see if I can see these arisings of karmic energy happening in this moment in this life. And sort of see if I can, start to get a deeper understanding in that way. Can I be mindful enough to see these things as they arise? So there's another big question that we have to ask at this point. Well, if me, this body, Barry, doesn't get to benefit from all this practice I'm doing, if I'm not going to get, next lifetime, I'm going to have a better time because I did all this stuff this time. If I don't become enlightened this lifetime, who knows? Why bother? And it's a really honest question you have to ask. Why bother? Why am I doing this? Why am I dedicating my life to practice? If in the end, at the end of this life, my connection to all that stuff is severed. Me, Barry, is gone. No benefit to Barry here at all. And I only have two answers to that. I mean, it's pretty empty to say, well, if I don't enjoy the fruits, why don't I just sort of do whatever I want to do? Who cares? Which is a pretty common way of looking at the world, actually. But it's pretty clear to me that in this lifetime, even in this limited little drop in the bucket lifetime, I experience the benefits of my practice. It's like I experience moment to moment and day to day, I experience the benefits of having done the practice I've done and that I continue to do. I see how different things are for me because I've done the practice I've done and continue to do. And that in itself is a really good reason to keep practicing, as far as I'm concerned. But the other thing is, if this bundle of karmic energy that I'm that's hanging around with me in this particular lifetime with this particular body mind, if I'm improving it, making it more wholesome, then I am literally contributing to some other being in some future lifetime being born and acting more wholesomely, that's a really good reason. Me, I don't benefit, but the world benefits. Ah, that's a pretty good reason. And so these are the two answers I have to the why bother question. One, I experience in this lifetime, I've ex already experienced the wholesomeness of that's arisen in my life based on the fact that I've done all this practice. It's really obvious to me that in and of itself. But then if I can think about that I'm creating a more wholesome stream that comes into another body at some point in the future, great. What could the world need more than that? So that's I feel comfortable with those two answers. And to finish off, so I just want to reiterate. So basically, these two things, karma and reincarnation, they're so bound together. And the other problem is they're often really strongly misunderstood. Hopefully, I've at least ameliorated some of the common misunderstandings that revolve around these topics because our culture has taken them and done all kinds of weird things with them, right? And I think it's just for me, though I'm still in the level of suspending my disbelief, when I look at this as a whole, all of the stuff I talked about, when I put it all together in my mind, it's like, boy, it makes sense. I'm really, that's what it comes down to. Yeah, this makes sense. It feels right. It has a positive, a real positive energy to it all. A real wholesome, positive vibe that feels right. And that in and of itself gives me confidence to at least give this talk, understanding that I just might be blowing smoke. But it makes sense to me and feels right, so okay, I'm okay with that. Okay. Little bit of poetry to finish off. Is from Mary Oliver's book Thirst. Remember, this is a series of poems she wrote soon after her longtime partner had passed away. And I was just sort of reading my poetry books, which I do. I'll sort of pull out a poetry book and just read it from time to time. I came across this. Oh, this is attached to what I've been saying in some way. It's called praying. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be a weed in a vacant lot, or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch a few words together. And don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but a doorway into thanks, and in a silence in which another voice may speak. That's that moment of insight. That's that voice that speaks. And in the silence in which another voice may speak. So there's not a lot of prayer in Buddhist tradition. But a prayerful attitude might be a wholesome idea in the sense of how she describes it, being open and not making it some big elaborate deal. She's just talking about being open to what's arising and being connected to it and paying attention. Because sometimes that voice that speaks when things are silent will be there in your mind.